foot Chittim Yacht Laguna Madre edition, as the rising sun lights up the sky in the neon pink. There we shake hands with J.T. Van Zandt, the son of a legendary Texas singer-songwriter, Towns Van Zandt, and something of a star himself in the world of fly fishing. As we grab our gear from the car, I realize I've forgotten the cooler I was hoping to fill with my single-day license daily limit of thread fish. No matter. Van Zandt informs me we won't be keeping any catches, and reminds me again that it would take nothing short of divine intervention for me to catch anything anyway. Later, I learn it's probably a good thing he didn't see the cooler, a disposable foam cheapie. I put on the sun protection gloves and face mask I'd brought at Van Zandt's recommendation, and smear SPF 10,000 on every uncovered patch of skin, and we set out. J.T. Van Zandt plays guitar and sings, sometimes performing his father's songs at various events, but he realized years ago the outdoors appealed to him more than music. He got hooked on fly fishing at age 21 while still recovering from a biking accident that left him with a badly broken leg and searching for a more grown-up sport. With no YouTube tutorials or social media connections to experts available instantly on a smartphone screen, he watched VHS tapes and talked to people at outdoors shops to learn. Evidently, he got good enough to guide anglers himself, and the hobby became one of his jobs. He poured creative energy into custom building gorgeous wooden-decked canoes, in addition to guiding for a time, but he's content now to make a living solely as a fishing guide. And he does have to make a living, he points out. Towns wasn't a keen businessman as he was a songwriter. My dad was a very irresponsible artist and signed some terrible agreements, J.T. says. The main thing I inherited was legal fees. Yet he already considers himself retired. He's now 51, a year shy of the age his dad died. I am retired from all the bull blank in my life, he says. I literally refuse to engage in anything my brain is telling me not to do. Van Zandt's style of fly fishing is sight casting, in which one visually acquires a fish and slings the fly directly in its range for a bite, rather than casting a fly atop a promising area and reeling it along the water's surface until a fish spots it. For someone who has never even held a fly rod like me, it adds the challenging need for accuracy to a style of casting that can already be tricky. Van Zandt does not hold back in criticizing my form as my fly lands in spots that have little to do with where I aim it. But the razzing doesn't feel barbed coming from someone so laid back. And as I told the two other men in the boat, I am feeling lucky. Van Zandt almost always releases his catches. The flies he crafts are barbless, so they slip easily out of a hooked fish's mouth as soon as it's netted for a quick victory photo. It's not that redfish are endangered. Commercial harvesting lowered their numbers to near extinction at times along the Texas Gulf Coast in the 70s and 80s. But the species rebounded after a 2007 executive order from President George Bush declared them a protected game fish. Today, licensed recreational anglers can keep a limited number that meet size requirements. Throughout and after our trip, Van Zandt speaks fondly, almost reverentially, about redfish. You know, I travel for fish of other species, but I am very much a proud Texan, he says. Sixth or seventh generation, originally Fort Worth, Van Zandt County up there. The county is in fact named for his family. So being from Texas and being proud of the state is a big part of my life. And redfish are what we have, number one. And number two, redfish are the fisherman's friend. They're one of the shallowest species of saltwater fish, meaning that as a beginner, you can come to catch redfish and they're more forgiving. As he motors or pull pushes us around, Van Zandt tells me the only meat he eats at home comes from animals he hunts himself. He speaks admiringly of President Theodore Roosevelt's dedication to conservation. He points and scoffs at a section of large new houses along the shore built by wealthy owners who only stay in them seasonally. We've got to get past the idea that progress is destroying a natural habitat, he says. More than once, he tells me the sight of single-use plastic conveniences like straws and grocery sacks infuriates him. Someone meeting him for the first time can avoid an awkward start to the fishing day by not packing bottled water or bringing a styrofoam cooler, I assume. Van Zandt brings jugs of cold water and clean drinking cups. He plucks plastic bottles and any other trash he spots out of the water and says he loves watching clients' sons and daughters pick up the same habit. A natural-born people-pleaser with a competitive streak, I feel a tinge of jealousy that these punk kids managed to impress Van Zandt. All I've managed so far is to irritate him by trying to make the point that corporations are far more responsible for environmental destruction than consumers, and that guilt-tripping individuals gives cover to the true villains. I've worded it much more cohesively here than I did in the boat. That doesn't take away an individual's responsibility, Van Zandt counters, ending the debate. I'm getting more anxious about my prediction of success. Certain that nothing I am doing will lead to a close view of a redfish, Van Zandt asks if we want to see one, as if he can simply catch one at will. He proceeds to do just that. After a couple of precise warm-up casts, he is reeling one in within seconds of my handing his rod back to him. The fish gives a game fight, but is no match for the man at the other end of the line. Van Zandt nets it and backs the fly hook out of the creature's lips, holding it firmly but delicately, as if it were a wriggling puppy, to show us. This redfish isn't red, though it has a pinkish hue to its fins, particularly in the tail, which also has a single black spot. Its iridescent scales gleam every color under the white morning sun. Then Van Zandt lowers it back home. We motor toward one of his favorite areas. Once we're in the vicinity, he notices an osprey dive into the water, so he directs the boat toward the spot, knowing it will be full of mullet, a bait fish that redfish and ospreys alike find irresistible. He cuts the engine and climbs onto the poling platform to push us through winding areas of clear water amid clumps of spartina on the shoreline. We glide up a creek and ease to a stop near what looks like a jacuzzi full of mud and thrashing silvery fish. Black cormorants perch on posts in the water nearby. The scents of salt water and decomposition and mud hung in the air. The only way I can come up with to describe it is that it smells like life, but I keep the thought to myself. This is a very fertile place, Van Zandt comments, as if reading my mind. My cast gets smoother. They don't look like professional, but with practice, Van Zandt's instruction has me dropping flies within a few feet, sometimes even inches, of a target. We move every few minutes as I scare off school after school of redfish. As our time ticks away, I grow increasingly distressed at the prospect of not catching anything. Van Zant will see a fish, and I'll look in the direction his finger is pointing, and maybe one out of three times I'll see what he sees, a shadowy oval just a shade darker than the surrounding water. I whip the rod back, forward, back again, and fling the fly at it, and the fish disappears from my sight, though Van Zant tracks it with his experienced sharpened eyes. Occasionally, I feel the line go taut, but it always proves to be a snag or a fleeting nibble. Then an unmistakable tug straightens the line. Instructions on what to do should this unlikely situation arise flood my head in jumbled order. I know I have to set the hook, so I pull the rod to the side. Then am not sure if I've done it correctly. Do I need to do it again before letting the loose of the line? Or do I let the fish run now? As I hesitate, the rod arcs down toward the water, then springs back up, trailing loose line. I lost it. Is there such a thing as half a miracle? I'm embarrassed to have lost my lone catch and one of Van Zant's flies, to have hooked some poor fish and left it with a gaudy lip piercing. But Van Zant waves off my apologies, selects another fly, and ties it on. When photographer Rodrique takes a turn with the rod, I switch places with Van Zant on the poling platform, and he tells me how to propel the boat while he repeats his casting lesson. He points in the general directions we should head. I move us onward, the boat turning a couple of degrees to the left with each push on my right side. It feels like I am doing it the same way I'd watched him do it, but my technique is off. Below me, Rodrique whips the rod and sends the fly on a haphazard course to nowhere in particular. They both laugh. "This is awesome," Van Zant says to Rodrique, and they laugh some more. "Jesse's pulling us in circles while you're just flailing all around." I manage a smile, then remember they can't see my face under my polarized sunglasses and baklava of sun-protective headgear, so I give a courtesy chuckle. The forced laughter becomes real as I ponder how seriously I am taking myself with my fisherman ninja outfit and my futile effort to push our boat arrow straight through the marsh. This is supposed to be fun. This is fun. Afterward, shelling peanuts, sipping cold beer, and chatting in the Swan Point Landing Fly Shop, managed by his friend Dave Hayward, Van Zant expands upon his philosophy, a common one among fly fishing guides and their clients, of seeing this form of angling as a gentler, more ecologically friendly form of the sport. "There are so many other things to see and enjoy other than bagging your limit of fish," he says. "Besides, he doesn't even like the taste. I'd rather eat an avocado," he says. I suspect his fondness for the redfish, that symbol of his Texas, mascot of his beloved spot on the central Texas coast, might have something to do with his distant distaste for them, but doesn't say so. "They're the fisherman's friend," he says. "They might reward you like that one did you today, in a situation where maybe you haven't earned, you haven't worked hard enough to earn that opportunity, but they'll reward you anyway, and they can be extremely challenging. You can take it from an extreme beginner level to an extreme expert level with a fly rod, and you're still going after the same species, just in a different environment. Redfish aren't as elusive as the permit fish, a cautious and picky eater," Van Zant says. "Once hooked, they won't offer an intense battle like one you might have with the massive, speedy, leaping tarpon. And that's just fine with him. He'd rather load up a boat with friends and beer and spend a few low-key hours relaxing on the water, not concerned an entire day could ride on landing a single perfect cast or witnessing a miracle. Here's a travel article entitled Miraval Mode. A luxurious Texas Hill Country resort offers experiences ranging from adventurous to indulgent, with an emphasis on disconnecting from technology and embracing the world around you. Before embarking on a trip to Miraval Austin, it helps if you know the answer to one simple question. What's your purpose? Opened early last year in the heart of Texas Hill Country, on the site of the former Travassa Austin Resort, Miraval Austin is neighbored by 220 acres of the Balcones Canyonlands Preserve, overlooking Lake Travis. The setting is as beautiful as it is serene, and I immediately felt lighter the moment I set foot on the property. Or, as the resort's motto suggests, life started to feel a little more in balance. Like the flagship Miraval Resort and Spa, situated outside Tucson, Arizona, the Austin offshoot is a choose-your-own-adventure-style retreat, offering unique activities for nearly every type of traveler. Whether you're in search of adventure, relaxation, or wellness of mind or body, Miraval's experienced planners can help you create a personalized itinerary for whatever your soul desires. When I visited the property last fall, my purpose was to get a taste of everything the resort had to offer. I recently left my full-time job as a magazine editor to try out life as a freelancer, so I was a woman in transition, and therefore a prime candidate for Miraval's mindfulness-based programming. A little bit of adventure sounded good to me, but so did some rest and relaxation. And who doesn't need to recommit to their mental and physical well-being every now and then? For my two-night stay in one of the resort's Dreamcatcher rooms, which are outfitted with a plushest, coziest feather beds I've ever experienced, I booked a spa treatment, some meditation classes, a tour of the property's on-site farm, and a session with one of Miraval's equine specialists. Upon check-in, I was happy to discover that Miraval's 20,000-square-foot Life in Balance Spa sat just a few steps from my room. I had a facial scheduled the day I arrived, a treatment my dull skin desperately needed, but I also had a new mystery novel I couldn't wait to crack open, and there was a chaise in the spa's relaxation room that was calling my name. The treatment I chose, the Vitamin C Facial, was billed as an intensive treatment that would brighten and stimulate skin, and best of all, the facial promised instant results. When my 50-minute session was over, my skin really did glow, and I felt more relaxed than I had in ages. Still dressed in my robe and slippers, I grabbed my book and made a beeline for the spa lounge, where expansive windows let in spectacular hill country views. It was the best possible way to kick off my stay. Because Miraval encourages living in the moment, a foreign concept for so many of us these days, cell phones and digital devices are permitted in designated areas only. As someone who checks email and Instagram about 1,000 times a day, I had a hard time sliding into Miraval mode at first, but by day two I was ready to embrace being untethered from technology. I popped out of bed that day, turned off my phone, and headed to morning meditation. I've struggled with meditation in the past, my mind instantly turning to my to-do list or messages that needed responses, or even just some random thought about a Netflix series I recently streamed. So I was determined to master the art of meditation this time. as our guide led a small group of us through the various stages of meditation, encouraging us to breathe deeply, relax, and give thanks, I managed to stay focused most of the time. My mind wandered a few times, but as with any journey, it's about progress, not perfection, so I still counted it as a win. It wasn't until my final day at the resort, however, that Miraval's mission came fully into focus. During my one-on-one session with equine specialist Paula Basden, I participated in a course called Common Ground. In this experience, you move a horse around a pen without touching or speaking, all in an effort to help you identify your communication strengths and challenges. This is about lifemanship and not about horsemanship, Basden said. It's about gaining some insights into how you show up in the major relationships that you're in and how you can change some of the behaviors and actions that you take and the way that you relate to the people you really care about. As Basden explained it, horses are hardwired for connection. And because of their natural instincts, they're able to give us immediate feedback about what's going on inside us. I never know what's going to happen when I put someone down in the arena with a horse, she said. Sometimes they get into the arena and they start crying. I nodded as Basden spoke, even though I didn't really understand how such a beautiful creature could make someone cry. But before I knew it, I was down in the arena myself, standing in front of a 1,200-pound horse named Pepper, who stared at me in silence as tears rolled down my face. I had spent the past few minutes frustrated because Pepper wasn't moving in the direction I wanted her to. After a while, I gave up, which admittedly is something I tend to do when things get too difficult. As Basden and I discussed my frustrations, Pepper strolled over and looked at me with her big, blinking eyes, and I think I know what she was trying to tell me. She was giving me a second chance. Your custom journey awaits. There's something for everyone at Miraval Austin. For the thrill seeker, for the adventurous among us, there's no better way to take in Miraval's surrounding nature than from the top of a 25-foot pole. Part of the resort's outdoor adventure series, the Quantum Leap experience, requires participants to ascend the pole, harnessed and helmeted, of course, then say goodbye to their comfort zone as they make a sky-high leap. But the pole jump is just the beginning of the bold activities that await at Miraval Austin. With swing and a prayer, for instance, you can face your fears while swinging from a cable 35 feet above the ground. Meanwhile, the Hill Country Challenge course, complete with high ropes and low ropes, takes you through a series of obstacles meant to help you set goals for yourself, then taste the triumph once you accomplish them. Throw in slacklining, hatchet throwing, archery, and a climbing wall, and you've got a full schedule of adrenaline-inducing experiences. On the dining front, adventure comes by way of the popular Just Cook for Me experience, in which executive chef Ben Baker and his team prepare their choice of mouth-watering dishes. The samples served are a complete surprise to diners, but they're guaranteed to be delicious. Even better, they're each paired with a fine wine. For the chill seeker, in addition to Miraval Austin's roster of relaxing activities, every guest room at the resort comes equipped with a meditation pillow, Tibetan singing bowl, and guided meditation TV channels, which means you don't even have to leave your room to get a meditation fix. But you do have to leave your room to check out the Life in Balance Spa, which features 30 treatment rooms, a pool, salon, sauna, and steam room. Treatment highlights include pranayama dina, which means flying breath in Sanskrit. A Miraval Austin exclusive treatment, this tension-taming floating massage lets you rock gently in a silk sling as your guide massages your muscles from below, using skilled foot techniques. For the health nut, with interactive courses such as restoring bone broth, flower to root cooking, mindful grocery shopping, and healthy gut, healthy you, Miraval Austin has your nutrition needs covered. Plus, the resort's kitchen offers healthful and sustainably sourced food morning, noon, and night, including fresh eggs and produce harvested from the on-site Cypress Creek farm. Fitness enthusiasts will also love Miraval's wide array of yoga classes, as well as the 5,600-square-foot Body Mindfulness Center, where guests can partake in spin classes, cardio drumming, kickboxing, and more. For a Texas twist on getting fit, sign up for country line dancing. You're in Austin, after all, so why not burn some calories while sweating to the country oldies? For the soul searcher, if a spiritual quest is what brings you to Miraval, start your journey with the cleansing ceremony. In this energy cleansing workshop, holistic healer Courtney Parnell helps guests let go of energy that no longer serves them, while sharing the purifying properties of plants such as Palo Santo and sage. Other offerings include tarot card workshops and a session called Cosmic Conversations, in which astrologer Emily Clintworth uses the time, date, and place of your birth to explore ideas about karma and reincarnation. But if you really want to look inward, the Miraval Equine Experience will help you identify any patterns of thought and behavior that might be holding you back.
Hello, this is Michael reading from True West Magazine, May 2020. The Real Texas Rangers. Nearly two centuries ago, Texas founding father Stephen F. Austin unofficially created the Texas Rangers to protect his fledgling colonists farming and ranching near the colony's capital of Velasco, along the Brazos River near the Gulf Coast. Ever since Austin's visionary call to arms in 1823, the Texas Rangers have been greatly admired, honored, respected, and feared enforcers of the law. They have served in war and peace on both sides of the border in the colony, republic, and state. They fought in the Texas War of Independence, the Mexican and Civil Wars, and defended Texas against invasions from Mexico countless times. The Rangers' hard-fought battles with their Mexican adversaries earned them the nickname Los Diablos Tejanos, the Texas Devils. Since True West began publishing from Austin, Texas in 1953, the history of the Texas Rangers and the men who wore the badge and rode the Texas Range in defense of the Lone Star State has maintained a constant source of inspiration for our editors, contributors, and readers. In 2020, as Texas begins a three-year bicentennial commemoration of the storied law enforcement agency, True West's editors have asked two of our regular contributors, Ranger historian Chuck Parsons and Western author and film historian Johnny D. Boggs, to share their expertise on the men who wore the star of a Texas Ranger, and on the 35th anniversary of Larry McMurtry's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Lonesome Dove. So saddle up and ride the whirlwind as Parsons and Boggs takes you down the trail of Texas's legendary lawmen and define why they remain icons of the Old West. La Frontiera by Chuck Parsons. During the 1820s, the province of Texas was an ideal place for spreading terror. Comanche raiding parties swept down the Great Plains to kill settlers or anyone who got in their way, and to kidnap women and children. The vastness of what is today Texas was a problem for the Mexican government. Moses Austin came up with an idea. Colonize the area with Americans from the southern states, providing history with the old 300 families who were brave enough or foolish enough to leave the security of their homes in the south to forge a new life in this great frontier. The majority of this article is made up of photographs. I'll be describing the photographs and reading their captions. Although unidentified, these 8 bust photos, gathered and framed by a collector, could easily be Texas Rangers of the late 1850s through 1860s period. They are wearing period clothing, and some eagerly show off their weapons. And this photograph is made up of 8 men. These are headshots. You can see their faces and their torsos. The first man on the upper left has a mustache, and it looks like he's wearing a sombrero. The man to the right is wearing a cowboy hat. To the right of him, a man who is not wearing a hat, but he is wearing a suit and is brandishing a pistol. The man on the far right of the top row is wearing a bow tie and a cowboy hat. On the bottom row, to the left, a man who is wearing a cowboy hat, he has a beard, and it looks like he is carrying a rifle. The man next to him is not wearing any hat. He's wearing a black suit, it looks like. The man to the right of him is wearing a black cowboy hat and a shirt. And the man to the very far right of the lower row is not wearing a hat. Looks like he's just wearing a shirt. Next photograph. Caption. John Woodard Wood Saunders, left, and Walter Durbin were photographed in South Texas. Wood Saunders began as a ranger under Captain Neil Coldwell in 1874 in Company F. He served off and on for many years, serving under Captain Lamar P. Syker, George H. Schmidt, Frank Jones, and John R. Hughes. Saunders was in the squad on Pirate Island when the ambush resulted in the assassination of Captain Frank Jones. He was honorably discharged in 1903. During those many dangerous years, he also served as a protection man on the huge XIT ranch in the panhandle of Texas, served as a deputy in El Paso County, a deputy under Pat Garrett after the killing of the Kid, and a U.S. Customs agent before his death on July 11, 1913 in San Antonio. This image also shows John Walter Durbin, who served nearly as many years as Saunders. He left the service for a brief period with Bass Outlaw and John R. Hughes to earn a higher salary guarding mine shipments in Mexico. Durbin later became sheriff of Frio County from 1892 to 1896, then served on the police force in San Antonio. He died on September 19, 1916. Lawing was truly in his blood. And to describe this image, we see 2 men who are both dressed similarly. It looks like they are wearing heavier materials for their pants, as well as a shirt, and then some sort of a small overcoat on each of them. They're both holding rifles. They both have pistols in their holsters, as well as an ammunition belt. They're both wearing mustaches, and they're wearing hats, and they're wearing boots. It looks like they're standing maybe in front of a rock wall of some sort. Now to the next photograph. The caption is, "This view shows Captain Ira Long with Company B Frontier Battalion during the late 1870s, preparing to start on a scout somewhere near Fort Concho in West Texas. At left, the men are loading the mules with necessary scouting rations. Captain Long is Mounted Ranger, second from left. This image has Sanders and Lester photographers stamped on the back." And what we're looking at here is it's a very wide shot taken from a bit of a distance, a line of horses, men on the horses, a couple of men that are standing near the horses. Even looks like maybe there's a dog in the photograph as well. taken from such a far position and able to be able to include all of the men and their horses that you can't really see much detail in the photograph other than the shapes of the images. Now we'll move to the next photograph. Caption accompanying photograph. This exquisite image of Lee Hall is the first known photograph of the lawman. The image, the original image, is a mere half inch by 1 inch, held in a 2.75 inch by 1.75 inch gutta-percha frame of floral design. This locket with image was certainly a gift from Hall intended for, perhaps, future wife Bessie C. Weidman, or it could have been intended for an unknown lady, courtesy of the Kurt House Collection. Again, we're looking at a headshot of a man. It is an oval-shaped photograph. The man is wearing a mustache. He is wearing medium short hair of the period and looks like he is dressed in a suit. In 1823, Stephen F. Austin employed 10 men to do an impossible task, protect the early settlers. This marks the beginning of the iconic Texas Rangers. John Jack C. Hayes, Sam Walker, Ben McCulloch, John B. Jones, Frank Hamer. These are just a few of the names which have become familiar to all. Men such as these became the mold for others to follow. Today, the Texas Ranger is recognized throughout the world as a symbolic figure for the quintessential peace officer. In our next photograph, the caption reads, "This photo is one of a group of great images of Company D at Camp Leona near Uvalde, Texas, by photographer Frank Chapman. With the absence of Captain Frank Jones, young Austin Ira Atten, in temporary command, is standing with coffee cup in hand. Seated on the ground from left, J.W. King, Frank Schmid, Ernest Rogers, Calvin G. Atten, younger brother of Ira Atten, Walter Jones, Charles Fuselman, J. Walter Durbin, James R. Robinson, John R. Hughes, and Basil L. Bass Outlaw. With the assassination of Fuselman and then Frank Jones, Sergeant John R. Hughes became captain of Company D." The caption of the photograph illustrates the picture very well. To give you a few more details, we're in the looks like we're in the middle of the country. It looks like a woods. Most of the men are seated in a semicircle in an open area of this country. There's one man who is standing up, and there are one, two, three, four, it looks like five or six horses in the background as well. You see trees without any leaves behind them also. On to our next photograph. The caption reads, "This Texas Ranger from the 1870s is obviously proud of his weaponry. The carbine and matched revolvers prominently displayed for the photographer and future generations. Unfortunately, no identification was provided." This photograph is a bit faded. The details are a bit hard to make out, but he is standing with, again, wearing, it looks like heavy material for his pants. He's wearing black boots and then some kind of a utility type of shirt. He's wearing an ammunition belt as well as two pistols in his holsters. And then he's leaned against his rifle, and he is wearing a hat. Looks not a cowboy hat. It's a bit more like a sombrero, and it has stars, probably four stars. We can see three of them on either ends of on each side of this hat. On to our next photograph. Caption reads, "A youthful Samuel H. Walker, whose name is immortalized by a pistol, the Walker Colt, was photographed without the pistol. Walker became the first hero of the Mexican War because he bravely delivered war messages to General Zachary Taylor during the battles of Palo Alto and Resaca de la Palma. Together, Walker and Samuel Colt redesigned the five-shot Patterson revolver into a six-shot .44 caliber revolver named the Colt Walker. Walker later returned to the Mexican War battlefields, but was killed October 9, 1847, at the Battle of Humantla. As it reads, a very youthful man. He's wearing a jacket, underneath that a vest, and then a white shirt, bow tie, and very medium short hair cut of the day. And as the caption said, he is not brandishing a weapon. Our next photo, caption reads, Noah H. Rose, collector of the Western Frontier photographs of the early 20th century, identified this image as Augustine Montague Gus Galdea, as he appeared in 1878 when he was associated with John Selman and his group of desperados. Galdea himself may have termed this band of outlaws as Selman Scouts, who operated in New Mexico and claimed he was the first lieutenant under outlaw John Selman. Galdea left several autobiographies, none complete or totally truthful. He was a wanted man, however, as Governor Lew Wallace listed wanted men of Lincoln County, and in addition to Billy the Kid's was Galdea's name. He wisely left Lincoln County and found more peaceful pursuits in Arizona and Texas, and drove at least one herd of cattle to Montana. In addition to his wanderings, he served in Company D Frontier Battalion from 1887 to 1890. This is an excellent image of a frontiersman armed to the teeth with six-shooter, knife, belts of ammunition, and rifle. And indeed, that is what we see here. We see a man with a mustache who is seated in a chair. He is holding his rifle in his right hand. He does have the belt of ammunition that goes across his chest, and then a second belt of ammunition that is around his waist. You can clearly see his pistol to the left on his holster. And he is wearing a hat, and again, a heavy-looking material for his pants, and he's wearing boots. Looks like a white shirt. Looks like he's also wearing gloves of some sort, some kind of heavy work-type gloves. On to our next photograph. Caption reads, James Thomas Tom Bird and friend John James Haynes were two young men from Blanco County who sought adventure a little further west. Haynes, at Wright, raised cattle and ranched while Bird became a Texas Ranger in the Frontier Battalion. Bird first served under Captain Cicero Rufus Perry in Company D, having mustered in on May 25, 1874. He later served under Captain Daniel W. Roberts, also in Company D, and finally under Lieutenant George W. Campbell in Company B. Note, both wear knee-high boots, are proud of their revolvers, and Haynes with a wide brim and low crown hat, which features hanging tassels. And indeed, that is the description of the photograph. They are both seated. They have their revolvers each in their right hands. And to the left, the man is clean-shaven. On the right, the man has a beard. And yes, that man's hat, which is hanging on, looks like on the armrest of the chair, does have tassels. Few Texas Rangers have come from Texas, and one who gained fame was from North Carolina. Jesse Lee Hall, born in 1849. After the Civil War, adventure drew him to Texas, where he became a lawman first in Grayson County, then in Austin. He gained fame as a lieutenant under Captain Leander H. McNelly. He then was made captain. His philosophy was the same as his first captain: get the job done, no matter what. His targets were thieves and murderers of all types on either side of the Rio Grande. On to this next photograph. The caption reads, one of the more famous images of Company D showing Captain Frank Jones and a dozen of his men, proudly showing their weaponry. Standing at rear, left to right, Jim King, Baz Outlaw, Riley Barton, Charles Henry Vanalkenberg Fusselman, William Tink Durbin, Ernest Rogers, and Walter Jones. Seated from left to right, Bob Bell, Cal Aiton, Captain Jones, James Walter Durbin, Jim Robinson, and Frank Schmidt. This beautiful image of Company D was made in Rio Grande City and backstamped L.P. Beckham Photographer. Of this group, King, Outlaw, Fuselman, and Captain Jones died violently, the former after service in the Rangers, while Fuselman and Jones were killed in the line of duty. The border then, as now, was a dangerous place. These men, again, they are all wearing hats, boots, all are holding rifles, and the men to the front are seated while the other men behind them are standing. Our next picture, caption accompanying photograph. Standing at left is the tall sheriff of LaSalle County, Charles Brown McKinney. This beautiful image shows him ready in the town, or more likely, in the Brasada of South Texas. Note his white-handled Colt with bowie knife just before it, his trouser bottoms stuffed in his boots. In February 1885, McKinney, with former Ranger Lee Hall, forged a peace treaty with Dr. O.C. Pope on an island in the Rio Grande, which only temporarily stopped senseless killings between Mexicans and Anglos. Next to him is the former captain, L.H. McNally, Ranger George W. Faro, serving as a deputy, courtesy of the Brush Country Museum, Cotulla, Texas. These two men are standing side by side. The man on the left has his pistol in its holster. He is wearing a shirt with a vest, his pants, and then the ammo belt around his waist. The man to the right is wearing a hat. He has a mustache. He's wearing a white shirt with a vest. His pistol is holstered at his side, and also wearing dark pants and boots. Our next photograph, caption reads, John Salmon Ford arrived in Texas shortly after the Battle of San Jacinto, but joined the Texas Army serving under Captain Jack Hayes. He later practiced medicine for a number of years, then served in the Texas Congress, served as editor of Austin's Texas Democrat newspaper. During the Mexican War, he served as adjunct of Hayes' company. One of his duties was to inform family members of the death of a loved one. He signed his letters with a R.I.P., which shortly thereafter became his nickname. While in the Texas Rangers, he fought Comanches as well as Raiders under Juan Cortina. During the Civil War, he commanded the 2nd Texas Cavalry and later served as mayor of Brownsville. He is wearing, it almost looks like a buckskin jacket of some sort. At the bottom, it has tassels. He's wearing gloves as well, and he's holding his hat in his right hand. And, of course, he has his pistol. It's holstered on his waist. From 1875 to 1880, Hall was a ranger. He fell to no outlaw's bullet, but to the heart of a young woman who insisted he resign from the Rangers if he wanted her hand in marriage. He didn't insist on her becoming a Texas Rangers wife. If he had, he may have become one of the four great captains, along with John R. Hughes, Bill McDonald, James A. Brooks, and John H. Rogers. Or he may have fallen to an outlaw's bullet as Captain Frank Jones. Now we'll move to the next picture, the caption accompanying photograph. Company D was not the only company of the Frontier Battalion who posed for a photographer. This image shows Captain James A. Brooks with his Company F, left, somewhere in South Texas in 1888. This is a unique image as it also shows John H. Rogers, a future Ranger captain. Standing in the back of the picture, left to right, are Frank Carmichael, Bob Bell, Curran Kid Rogers, younger brother of John H. Rogers, Gene Bell, and Jim Harry. In the front, seated, left to right, Tupper Harris, Sergeant J.H. Rogers, Captain James A. Brooks, Charles Rogers, and Bob Crowder. These men, all dressed similarly to the men that I've described before, all have their rifles that are either resting on them or that they're holding in their hands. Next photograph, caption reads, "This is among the frequently exhibited Ranger images of the 1890s period, probably because the photographer posed the men well, showing their weapons. Standing are Privates Robert Speaks and Jim Putman, the latter having survived the bloody shootout with Fine Gillian in the Glass Mountains of West Texas. Seated are Alonzo Lon Odin and Corporal John Reynolds, Border Boss Hughes." Odin later wrote of his experiences of as a Texas Ranger. This image of four men of Company D was made at Shafter in Presidio County. The two men are seated in the front. The other two men are standing just a little bit behind them, and they're all wearing the garb of the era and holding their rifles. Our next picture, caption accompanying photograph, Ranger Captain Joseph Shelley and his men of Company F were photographed in 1882. Standing from left, James M. Buck, 1st Sheriff of LaSalle County, Samuel E. Pete Edwards, Captain Shelley, George W. Farrow, William T. Brock Morris, and Charles Norris. Seated from left, Washington W. Shelley, younger brother of the captain, Tom Mabry, Robert Crowder, and Cecilio Charo. Courtesy Western History Collections, University of Oklahoma Libraries, N.H. Rose Collection, number 1409. This photograph is, again, being a bit older, is a little grainy, but you can definitely see the men. They're all wearing hats. Most of them have mustaches, wearing shirts, vests, ammo belts around their waist, and holding their rifles. To the next photograph, caption reads, Captain L.H. McNally, in 1872, was tasked to find and capture the Adjutant General of Texas, James Davidson, suspected of stealing thousands of dollars from the state treasury. McNally followed his trail to Montreal, Canada, but Davidson had managed to elude McNally and eventually settled in New Zealand, never to return to Texas. This image is one of two made by Montreal photographer James Inglis, courtesy the Albert and Ethel Hernstein Library, San Jacinto Museum of History, La Porte, Texas. We are looking at a headshot of a man with a full beard, mustache, hair, dark hair, and he is wearing, it looks like a suit, and it's one of those photographs, it's oval-shaped, and as it goes outward, it fades just a little bit into the background. Hall resigned from the Rangers and eventually served during the Spanish-American War and later in the Philippine Insurrection. Wounds suffered in battle there forced him to leave the service. He died in 1911 and is buried in the National Cemetery in San Antonio. Chuck Parsons' works focus on the real Texas Rangers and the outlaws they chased. His biographies of Wes Hardin, Jack Helm, and John R. Hughes established him as a quality researcher. His latest book is Texas Ranger Lee Hall, From the Red River to the Rio Grande, University of North Texas Press, 2020. We're almost out of time this week for the Western Magazine Hour, so we won't have time to read the Lonesome Dove article, but we will have it next week. For the rest of the next couple of minutes, I'm going to read letters written by readers of True West Magazine in the column Ask the Marshal. How did folks handle death in the Old West? Frank Perry, Fresno, California. Then and now, death always brings a lot of heartache, especially with family. In the Old West, families had to deal with it more frequently. Childhood mortality was high. It wasn't uncommon for a family with seven births to lose four of the children in childbirth or due to some affliction or epidemic. A wife might die giving birth. A husband might be killed in a work accident, especially mining, ranching, and railroading. The average lifespan for a man in 1900 was only 47 years. Science, penicillin, medicine, diets, sanitation, and the elimination of such afflictions as smallpox, diphtheria, polio, and typhoid increased that number. What's the story of the duel between Mace Bowman and Clay Allison? Joe Manriquez, Whittier, California. Bowman was a Texas feudist and sheriff of Colfax County, New Mexico. Allison, even at the time, was a noted shootist. Supposedly, the two met at Lambert's Inn in Cimarron, New Mexico. Over several drinks, they debated who was the faster gun. They put a gallon of whiskey up for the winner of a mock shootout. The two started with their backs to one another, walked several paces, turned and pulled their pistols. Before Allison could get his from the holster, Bowman had his gun cocked and aimed at his opponent's chest. Allison conceded. They then went off and shared the jug of whiskey. There were some stories that they battled in earnest at a later point, but that's just a myth. It's likely that Allison's reputation as a fast draw was exaggerated. He was a drunk who had no qualms about shooting other men, whether they had a chance to draw or not. Were the trails of wagon trains really littered with the possessions of families who tried to lighten their loads? John Volz, LaGrange, Kentucky. Yes, the trails were littered with furniture and anything else that wasn't critical. Going through deserts or mountains often required lighter loads just to continue the trek. This was especially true on the transcontinental Missouri to Oregon or California journeys. Is it true that women of soldiers were shared by other troopers in the West? Charlene Lewis, New York, New York. It's likely there were some wife swapping on those isolated frontier posts, especially in common law relationships. That occurred primarily among the enlisted forces. The married officers often had their wives on the post, but having sex with another officer's wife could be a career-ending move. Still, just like in any occupation in mainstream society, there would have been some philandering going on. Young men being men and young women being women, sometimes things happened. Why do cowboys saddle up on the left side? Ed Anderson, Apple Valley, California. That dates back to medieval times when most warriors were right-handed and carried a sword on their left side. It was much easier to mount from the left. Also, horses are creatures of habit, and studies have shown that the horse's left eye is stronger and they're less suspicious of someone approaching from their left. Did Old West gunslingers really put notches on their guns? Clay Olson, Rapid City, South Dakota. If you had asked me that question a few years ago, I probably would have said, that's the stuff of pulp fiction in Hollywood. But upon some reflection, I would say that a few did carve notches on the grips of their smoke wagons. Still, it wasn't commonplace. Wyatt Earp reportedly told his biographer, Stuart Lake, I never knew a man who amounted to anything to notch his guns with credits, as they were called, for the men he had killed. Outlaw gunmen of the Wild Crew, who killed for the sake of brag, followed this custom. I've worked with most of the noted peace officers, Hickok, Timon, Masterson, Bassett, and the others of like caliber, have handled their weapons many times, but I never knew one of them to carry a notched gun. Marshall Trimble is Arizona's official historian and vice president of the Wild West History Association. His latest book is Arizona Oddities, Land of Anomalies and Tamales, History Press, 2018. If you have a question, ask the Marshall, P.O. Box 8008, Cave Creek, Arizona, 85327. Or email him at marshall.trimble@scottsdalecc.edu. Please always include your name, city, and state. Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been... Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour. Followed by Music and Memories at 1. Texans have always connected over shared stories, and that's more important than ever right now. During this time, as reading services have a reduced number of readers, many of the national publications we air are not being produced. Thankfully, some of our local volunteers have agreed to take on additional reading for a locally produced substitute program, Texas Monthly Archives. Each week, we'll read features and columns from past editions of the Magazine of Texas. Some of these articles date back to the 1970s and 80s.